Good evening. Welcome to Constitutional Conversations with Dr. David Gray Adler. I'm KISU FM's Jamin Anderson. We are partnering with the Alturas Institute to help put tonight's event on, and tonight's topic will be on presidential powers. We want to remind everyone there is another Constitutional Conversations next week, Monday, October 28th. That's from 7 to 8:30 p.m. But that one will be in Idaho Falls at the Binion Building. And anyone who can travel that far or tell a friend, we'd love to see you there as well. I'd like to take a moment just to introduce our speaker this evening. Dr. Adler is the president of the Alturas Institute, which is a nonprofit organization created to promote the Constitution, gender equality, and civic education. Adler has received many awards, lectured nationally and internationally, and published widely on the Constitution, presidential powers, and the Bill of Rights. He is author of 6 books and more than 100 scholarly articles. He is currently writing a book on the landmark Supreme Court decision in Reed v. Reed, which had its origins in Idaho and transformed the law for American women. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg will write the foreword for that book. I gave you a hard time about the release date last week, and I'm sorry about that.
Sorry.
I want to say one thing, though. So my nephew asked my mom, what are you going to be for Halloween, Grandma? And she said, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And so ever since, I've been scouring the store shelves looking for that costume, and I think it just probably sold out. I'm not sure. I haven't seen it yet. So he has consulted with members of Congress from both parties on a variety of constitutional issues, including impeachment and the war powers and termination of treaties. Adler has taught courses on the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and the Supreme Court at all 3 universities here in Idaho. He has served as the director of the Andrus Center for Public Policy in Boise and as the director of the McClure Center for Public Policy Research at the University of Idaho. Previously, he was professor of political science and director of the Center for Constitutional Studies here at Idaho State University, and he remains a lecturer at the University of Idaho College of Law. He earned a BA from Michigan State University and a PhD from the University of Utah. He is a founding member of the City Club of Idaho Falls and is a recipient of the Idaho Humanities Council's Distinguished Humanities Award. And I had to leave a whole lot off because I knew that the introduction was going to get long. Thank you, Dr. Adler.
Thank you, Jamin. Thank you very much. That was a very nice introduction. Good to see you all tonight. Glad you could join us, and welcome to everybody in Meridian. Nice to have you join us as well, and I hope that we'll hear some good questions from you later in the evening. As Jamin mentioned, and I appreciate again, Jamin, the fact that KISU is a sponsor of our event and broadcasting these talks. I deeply appreciate that. Alturas Institute, as Jamin said, is a 501c3 organization, an educational organization organized to promote the Constitution, civic education, gender equality, and equal protection of the law. And toward that end, we host a number of programs throughout Idaho and across the country, all seeking to promote our mission statement. Tonight's talk seems to be one of interest. Here in Pocatello and across the nation, certainly the issue of the scope of presidential power, for many, many years, an issue of considerable debate and controversy in America, has been revived just in the last 2.5 years, particularly because President Donald Trump has laid claim to a very broad scope of presidential power. You may recall that on July 23 of this past summer, he told a college crowd that, quote, I can do anything I want to under Article 2 of the Constitution, anything I want to. Well, that statement by a president that he enjoys unlimited power rang the changes across the country, because despite the fact that historically speaking, many presidents have asserted very broad powers, Republicans and Democrats, conservatives and liberals alike, nevertheless, we've never had a president who has claimed unlimited power. And that raises the issue of, well, what does that mean for the nation? What does that mean for the presidency? And when you combine that assertion of power with some of his more recent statements about his intentions with respect to national policy and international policy, you begin to get a sense that he really means what he says, that he can do anything he wants to. How have we seen this manifested, you might wonder? Well, recall that, among other things, he refers to the State Department as my State Department. It's my Army. It's my FBI. It's my Attorney General, bringing to bear a sense of personal ownership over governmental agencies that we've never heard expressed by any other president. Indeed, one would have to travel back in time to the mid-17th century in England, when the Stuart kings were at the height of their powers, to hear a king refer to agencies and branches in his government as mine. So, in a sense, President Trump is trotting out a theory of presidential power that vastly exceeds even that great trajectory of presidential power that defined the emergence of the imperial presidency going back to the mid-1960s. That was a period of time, you may recall, in which both Presidents Johnson and Nixon asserted virtually complete control over the power to go to war, over our national security apparatus, and the control of American foreign policy. And once that imperial presidency was launched, it has never come to a stop. It's never landed, so to speak. It might have flown at a somewhat lower altitude under such caretaker presidents as Jimmy Carter and Gerald Ford. But certainly presidents, to be fair, have asserted very broad powers. But as I say, not anything like President Trump. What are more examples? He has referred to the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution as phony. The Emoluments Clause is that part of the Constitution that we never had to talk about until he assumed the presidency. And the Emoluments Clause was one of the primary mechanisms placed in the Constitution by the framers on the basis of their concern to prevent bribery, to prevent foreign interference in our governmental system. And so the Emoluments Clause prohibits the president or any United States officer from receiving any compensation, gifts from a foreign government. The aim there is, again, to prevent foreign influence. In so many ways, we can best understand the Constitution, including the Emoluments Clause, by asking, what was the historic purpose? What were the activities or the events at the time that led the framers to draft that clause? Well, the answer is pretty simple. It's pretty exciting and it's pretty colorful. Consider, for example, that before the United States became a government under the American Constitution, that American ambassadors, including Benjamin Franklin and John Adams, were routinely receiving gifts from the monarchs of the countries in which they were serving their country as ambassadors. But, of course, they were honest men and duly reported the gifts that were being given, for example, in France by King Louis to Ben Franklin, or in Spain by King Philip to John Adams. In the case of Ben Franklin, you'll like this, Ben Franklin reported to the Continental Congress that he, like all the other ambassadors then serving at the Capitol in Paris, had received a beautiful painting of King Louis, and everybody was so excited to receive it, not because they were fans of King Louis, but because the painting came in the form of a beautiful frame studded with diamonds. And so the ambassadors were so happy to receive a painting. Maybe some asked for two. And they would take the painting, and then they would remove the painting from the frame, and then ultimately remove the diamonds from the frame. Well, Ben Franklin said this isn't cricket, as he informed the Continental Congress. And the Congress then discussed and debated this issue. what gifts, if any, should our foreign ambassadors be able to keep? Because the concern is that there will be many efforts by foreign monarchs and others to buy the sentiments, the sympathies of the United States. Better not to put our ambassador in that sort of position. And so the Congress then began the practice of saying, if you ever receive a gift, tell us what it is. We will make the determination if you can keep it. Probably not those diamonds, Ben. Sorry. You have to pay for your retirement in another way. At about that same time, John Adams was in Spain representing the United States in a ministerial capacity. And because King Philip knew that John Adams was a fan of the ponies, he gave him ponies. So Adams referred that matter to Congress. In this case, Congress said, sure, you can keep a horse, John. Well, all of that backdrop helped to influence the framers of the Constitution when they wrote the Emoluments Clause, because they took it very seriously. Indeed, the framers were particularly concerned that, in fact, foreign influence might begin to weave its way through the American governmental process, and before you knew it, it would be other countries who were dictating American policy. So hence the prohibition found in the Emoluments Clause that says that a president may not take any gifts or compensation. There is the provision that Congress can always grant a waiver. So for example, when President Barack Obama received the Nobel Peace Prize a decade or so ago, which comes with $1 million in prize money, Congress permitted him to distribute those funds to particular charities in which he was interested, but they weren't going to let him keep the $1 million. So Congress makes that decision. But what I think is important for us to know is that the framers were so concerned about foreign influence in our domestic affairs and foreign intervention in our elections, not to mention foreign interference in our formulation of American foreign policy, that in various sections of the Constitution, they took great care to provide great protection against foreign interference. Consider the Treaty Making Clause as just one example. The Treaty Making Clause, as you know, provides in Article 2 that the President and the Senate together shall make treaties. The thinking in the Constitutional Convention, as expressed by James Madison, whom we rightly refer to as the father of the Constitution because he was its chief architect, the purpose in that arrangement, Madison explained, was to make it more difficult for foreign countries to influence our treaty-making decisions. He frankly said on the floor, it's a lot more difficult to bribe many members of the Senate than it is to bribe one person, the president. So imagine the framers thinking about and indeed fearing the prospect of a foreign government bribing an American president, or otherwise influencing or in some way coercing an American president to do the bidding of that country. Already then, the framers had that on their minds, even when they sat in the same room with the great George Washington, whom everybody knew would be the first president. The Emoluments Clause, as I say then, was one of those parts of the Constitution with which Americans were pretty unfamiliar, and indeed scholars almost never addressed it until President Trump assumed office, and suddenly there was the issue, what should he do with his allegedly vast empire? I say allegedly because, as you know, we still don't know about the scope of his wealth. We don't know about the scope of his holdings. There is an ongoing lawsuit, as you know, to gain access to his taxes and financial records. Stay tuned on that. So the question arose when President Trump assumed office. Now, what should he do with his business interests? Previous presidents, including Jimmy Carter, had placed those business interests in a blind trust so that he would not know what the business was doing. He would not know what decisions were being made to move the business along, move it right, move it left, move it up, move it down. And that's as it should be, so that there would be no conflict of interest between a president potentially exercising the powers of his office to affect the economy or trade relations in a way that might also benefit his business interest. But as you know, President Trump refused to place his interest in a blind trust. He said, "I'm turning it over to my sons and we'll never have a conversation about it." Well, we have learned, everybody, the whole world knows now, that since he assumed office, the representatives of many foreign governments have purchased leases in his buildings, some in New York, some in Washington, some elsewhere. People representing foreign governments stay in his hotels, eat in his restaurants, they visit his club in Florida, all of which, to make a long story short, leads to foreign governmental officials putting money in President Trump's family pockets. So that has led to lawsuits challenging these actions. And just the other day, we learned that an appellate court has allowed this suit to go forward, as much as the Trump administration fought it, which means that we'll have a decision by an appellate court, and that will go to the Supreme Court. One of many lawsuits, I think, involving Donald Trump that are going to the Supreme Court. So people have grown very concerned about President Trump's assertion that under Article 2 he can do anything he wants, including, apparently, ignore the Emoluments Clause. Another familiar claim made by the Trump administration on behalf of the president and reasserted just a couple of days ago in federal court is that the president cannot be investigated, cannot be prosecuted, and cannot, in fact, be forced to turn over financial records. And any suits being brought against him will fall by the wayside because he enjoys a, quote, absolute immunity from lawsuits. So if you follow the news, just the other day in the Second Circuit Court of Appeals in New York City, the Trump lawyers in there were arguing that the subpoena issued by congressional committees to his accounting firm to turn over the financial records to the committees conducting investigation could not be turned over because the president is immune from the judicial process. Let me say that again. The president is immune from the judicial process. He cannot be ordered to comply with a subpoena. He cannot be ordered to comply with an investigation or request for documents. That's when, and you might have seen the colloquy play out, printed in newspapers across the country, that in fact one of the judges, a three-judge panel, says to the attorney for Donald Trump, "Are you saying, hypothetically, that if a president shot somebody on Fifth Avenue, that he could not be charged with a crime?" And Donald Trump's lawyer said, "Yes, that's what we mean." At that point, the judge said, "So you mean as long as he's president, he could shoot people and he could never be charged?" "That's correct, Your Honor." Well, ladies and gentlemen, what that does is to erect the scaffolding for an absolute executive above the law. This claim does great violence to the principle of the rule of law. We're all familiar with that majestic theme, the rule of law, the heart and soul of America's constitutional legal system. What we want to remember, of course, is that at the time of the founding, that principle, the rule of law, had a very specific meaning. It was a term of art. In the framers' minds, that meant that the executive would be subordinate to the law. And the framers of the Constitution were entitled to consider the subordination of the executive to the rule of law as one of their greatest achievements, because while it had been attempted elsewhere, it had never been achieved. It had never been effectuated. So you wonder, as they now hear the assertions by a president's personal lawyer that the president cannot be investigated, cannot be charged, cannot be forced to turn over financial documents, you wonder about James Madison and Alexander Hamilton in their respective graves. Are they, in fact, turning over and over and over? It's a crazy world they occupy now, and they would think a crazy world that we occupy. So that does great violence to the essence of the rule of law, without which constitutional democracy could not survive. So let me repeat that again and say that I am saying this with no exaggeration, that if a president cannot be investigated, cannot be charged, cannot be held amenable to the judicial process, in my mind, that means clearly the president is above the law. And then, how do you hold that president accountable? So when Donald Trump said on July 23 of this summer, I can do anything I want to under Article 2, apparently he's not kidding. What else? Well, let's turn to a little conversation that the president had with the Ukrainian president on July 25, just 2 days after he makes this boastful claim. I'm not going to go into the details about the Ukrainian phone call because we discussed that last week when we met to discuss impeachment, other than to say, of course, the whole world now knows, in light of testimony from State Department officials, ambassadors, foreign ministers, that President Trump did indeed pressure the president of Ukraine to conduct an investigation into his principal opponent, Joe Biden, in return for military aid that had been authorized and appropriated by Congress, and also a meeting with the president in the White House. It was the condition of the release of the money. If you promise to conduct the investigation, then I'll release the funds. Ambassador William Taylor, 2 days ago, testified before the House Intelligence Committee and made those very clear statements. And that's what led him to say that we all see now through the text messages, this is crazy to condition the military assistance on the premise that the president of Ukraine will indeed make a, quote, public promise to investigate the Bidens. That was what Donald Trump's condition was, that you must make a public promise to investigate the Bidens. Well, President Trump then, of course, claimed that under Article 2, he can do anything he wishes, apparently even to engage in what we would call a shakedown. This was a good old-fashioned shakedown. Others would say it was an extraction. Others would say it's extortion. Others would say it's bribery. Bribery because I want you to do this for that. Meets the essential definition, the essential legal definition of bribery. So what we have here, without going into more detail at this point, is a president who does believe he has unlimited power under Article 2, cannot be held accountable, and resents it greatly when congressional committees are going to investigate him as they are now. And he resents it so greatly that he even charms his Republican members of the House to storm the House Intelligence Committee hearing room yesterday. You all saw this on television, which was the aim of this stunt, so that they go in to the room breaking House rules. Nobody but committee members are permitted in that room particularly, and understand this room was constructed with a particular concern to maintain national security. And secondly, no electronic devices are permitted. And here the Republican members of Congress doing President Trump's bidding come in with their phones on. And this greatly outraged members of the national security apparatus, who said, we have been so concerned to protect the integrity of this room because Our foreign adversaries want to know everything they can about this room, about anything they can see in this room, how we do business, where we sit, etc., to try to acquire intelligence about our foreign policy. So I'll leave that section at that point, but want to add some color to this, as if that's not colorful enough. Since the dawn of the Republic, it's fair to say that scholars and some politicians have argued about the scope of executive power. That's only fair to acknowledge. But we could say that inside the convention, inside the Constitutional Convention in the summer of 1787, that the framers themselves were very clear on the office that they were inventing. And the framers indeed did invent the presidency. It's one of their greatest contributions to the world of political science and law. And when they were creating the office of the presidency, their primary thought was, how do we create an administrative presidency so as to provide for the efficient enforcement of the law, the efficient immediate enforcement of the law, and somebody to carry out the executive responsibilities of the government? That was uppermost in their mind because under the Continental Congress, of course, the nation had no chief executive, no president, no chief executive, and the only way that Congress could carry out its executive functions was to organize a series of ad hoc committees and say to the committee, here, you enforce these laws, you enforce these programs and policies. That's no way to run a business or a government, so to speak. And so the framers wanted to create a presidency. But that generation lived in dread fear of a powerful executive, as you would understand, because, of course, they had just fought a war with England to free themselves of an executive tyrant. And the last thing they wanted to do was to recreate an embryonic monarch on American soil. So how to strike a fine balance between empowering the president sufficiently so that he could carry out his primary duties of enforcing the laws, making appointments to office, and not so greatly empower the president that he would represent a threat to the nation. This is the backdrop against which the framers engaged in discussion and debate in the long summer of 1787. Here in a nutshell is what they decided. On June 1, the very first day they took up the issue of creating the presidency and deciding what powers and duties and responsibilities to vest in the office, on that very first day, a motion was made that the president should inherit the executive powers, the executive rights exercised by the Congress. Let's just say that because we need an executive, all of those executive responsibilities and powers wielded by Congress should now be shifted and vested in the president. That seemed to strike the framers as a good idea until one delegate raised his hand and said, but would that mean that the president then is going to inherit the war power, which is currently exercised by Congress, on the theory that the war power, the power to go to war or the power to initiate hostilities on behalf of the American people, might be considered an executive power? Very quickly, three other framers rose, and you can see this in the debate, and they said, no, that cannot happen because in a republican form of government, the likes of which we're creating, it would be inappropriate to give the war power to the president because the writers on the Law of Nations all agree that the war power is indeed a legislative power, not an executive power. Why would they consider it to be a legislative power? Because when you go to war, you change the legal foundation, the legal circumstances of the country from a state of peace into a state of war with domestic law implications and also international legal implications, including among others, when you go to war, you can prohibit people from trading with the enemy. That's the whole point of shifting from a state of peace to a state of war. And it was further explained that because only Congress can change the legal conditions in the country, because it possesses the legislative, that is, the lawmaking power, it's appropriate that Congress alone would control the power to go to war. Nobody dissented that day. Nobody on that first debate, on that first day of debate on June 1, disagreed with that principle or that premise. The very next time, in fact, that the framers took up the question about the repository, that is, the location of the war power in the Constitution, was on August 17. And on that day, a representative from South Carolina began by making a motion saying, "I think that the president should have the power to take the nation into war, because he would never do so except when our national security requirements compelled such a decision." At that point, there was a piling on of this poor representative. Piling on, and imagine those football games that we watch here with the Bengals on Saturdays, piling on the tacklers. And they immediately said, the opponent said, they were shocked. They never thought they would hear in a republic the idea that the war power would be given to the president. Give this delegate a bit of credit. By the end of the day, he had done a complete reversal, and he introduced a motion that day that said, just as Congress alone has the power to take the nation into war, so too should Congress alone have the authority to decide when to end a war. Months later, when this fellow was in his state ratifying convention, sharing with his fellow state ratifying delegates news of what the framers had done in writing the Constitution, he's told his colleagues, "At one point in Philadelphia, some delegate had the temerity to suggest that the president should have the war power. That idea was quickly defeated." He never acknowledged that he was that fellow. So what emerges from the Constitutional Convention is the unanimous agreement that only Congress can take the nation into war, whether it's a full-blown declaration of war under Article 1, Section 8, which is the War Clause, or it amounts to lesser hostilities, minor hostilities, only Congress would possess that authority. Why? Once again, looking at the backdrop of history, the framers keenly aware of the propensity of executives everywhere, kings, tyrants, and the rest, to take their people into war for less than meritorious reasons, often to serve the monarch's interests, whether they are political or pecuniary or personal, did not want to give the American president, a single man, that opportunity to inflict that kind of damage on the United States. I can't think of any other section of the Constitution of comparable importance in which we can say there was a unanimous agreement. Unanimous. And so if you think about the fact that the framers to a man agreed that only Congress would have that authority to take us into war because of their fear of one man and their commitment to the essence of republicanism, which they defined as the conjoined wisdom of the many, that is, the combined wisdom of the many, being superior to a single person. We want group decision-making here before we go to war. We want the representatives from the four corners of the country to engage in a very serious, solemn discussion and debate before we decide to commit American blood and treasure to foreign battlefields. In no other area, as I say, can we find unanimity in the way we can find it here behind the War Clause. No dissent in the state ratifying conventions. No, nothing in the Federalist Papers that would lead us to believe the framers held a contrary conclusion. And indeed, in the early years of the Republic, the Supreme Court weighed in on several occasions in 1801, 1803, 1804, and 1806, holding that Congress alone has the authority to take us into war. That authority, James Madison explained, includes the authority to commence war, to continue it, and to conclude it. I always tell my students, these are the three C's. The power to commence, that is, start a war, the power to conclude it, to end it, and in between, the power to continue it includes congressional power to determine what the course of the war will be. It's important to acknowledge that Congress would have the superior authority to decide, for example, to make war on this continent, but not this continent. For Congress, perhaps, to decide we will deploy troops here, but not here. And if there's ever a conflict, the Supreme Court said in an 1804 case called Little versus Berrame, in an opinion by the great Chief Justice John Marshall, that if there's ever a conflict, the president is required to obey statutory instructions. Meaning, if Congress says to the president, you may not move troops out of Syria, then the troops have to stay. A lesson that could have been culled by our current Congress, many of whom howled when President Trump made the unilateral decision to remove our troops from northeast Syria, an area in which American soldiers had given their lives, in which 10,000 Kurds had died, in which we had spent billions of dollars to control. And then after a short conversation President Trump had with the Turkish President Erdogan, he conceded to Erdogan's interest in having U.S. troops withdrawn. And as soon as we withdrew our troops, then you saw the unholy footage of Russian soldiers coming in to occupy the bases that we built and defended, as if the United States rolled out the red carpet for the Russians. For members of Congress who were appalled by this, and we know the resolution passed by the House in great opposition was something like 350 or 360 to 50 or so, overwhelming number. If they knew their history, if they understood the Constitution, to which they take an oath to defend and preserve and protect, they could have said to President Trump, you're not removing the troops. So here's a history lesson. Here's a civics lesson for all Americans, including members of Congress. It's good, it's wise to understand the scope of congressional powers because Congress could have stopped it instead of complaining about it after the fact. In the same way that the framers vested in the Congress the full authority over the initiation of military hostilities, so too did the framers grant the lion's share of foreign policy powers to Congress. In this shared arrangement for the formulation, management, and conduct of American foreign policy, the framers made Congress the senior partner, not the junior partner. And thus, if you compare Article 1 of the Constitution, which is the legislative article granting Congress its powers, with Article 2, the President's powers, which are few and far between, lean and meager in comparison to Article 1, you would see that there's no doubt that Congress is supposed to play the lead role over American foreign affairs. But as you well know, for the last half century or more, the president has assumed the lead role in contrast to what the Constitution says. And this is the story of the imperial presidency. What we see different in the behavior of President Trump, quite apart from the imperialist presidents of both parties, is that he believes he can do anything he wants, unrestricted by the Constitution. At least previous presidents, as erroneous as their views were, as unjustified as their views were, they were still engaged in the business of arguing about the Constitution. But President Trump's view of having an unlimited authority means I don't even have to think about other clauses of the Constitution, other provisions that might grant to Congress some powers, because I can do anything I want under Article 2. So the vast scope of executive authority over foreign affairs, President Trump believes, now would allow him to cut this kind of a deal with the Ukrainian president. If you want the military aid that Congress has authorized, then you're going to do what I want you to do before I release that money. And that he could eliminate or remove members of his foreign service, including the UN, including the U.S. ambassador to the Ukraine, because she was trying to prevent the corrupt actions of Rudy Giuliani and others working on behalf of President Trump. So she was fired because she would not participate in the scheme of corruption. So that's a pretty frightening concern. If we look beyond those areas and ask what also can the president do in the realm of domestic affairs from the perspective of Donald Trump's absolutist view, then the question also would be almost anything he wants to do. So for example, even though you all know that under Article 2 of the Constitution, there is the famous Take Care Clause as well as the Appointments Clause, President Trump believes he's not bound by responsibilities. If he felt bound by the Take Care Clause, which is the essence of the framers' attempt to create a presidency limited by law, who would apply, that is, enforce the laws, then he would not be ignoring the Emoluments Clause or the other statutes that he's violating. Instead, the Take Care Clause, which says, quote, he shall take care to faithfully execute the laws, would have significance. But it has no more significance than the Advice and Consent Clause of Article 2 has. The Advice and Consent Clause provides that when the president nominates people to office, whether it's cabinet positions or many, many others, that the Senate is supposed to play its role in advising or consenting, that is, to ultimately decide to confirm that nominee or to reject the nominee. How has President Trump interpreted the Advice and Consent Clause? In a word, the Senate is irrelevant. He has a record number of people serving in the cabinet and high offices who have never gone through the confirmation process, but are simply, quote unquote, acting directors, the acting chief of staff, the acting secretary of state, acting secretary of defense, and so forth. President Trump said he prefers acting heads of departments so he can fire them when he wants to. That scuttles the entire purpose of the Advice and Consent Clause. What was that purpose? Again, drawing on history, the framers of the Constitution were keenly aware of the fact that because the king could hire and fire his cabinet members at will, there was no way to check the king's judgment. And so the framers, wanting to avoid the problems created by unilateral decisions, that is, decision by a single person, provided the joint power exercised by the president and the Senate. Beyond the fact that the president certainly prefers acting heads because he can move them out on a whim, who loses? The Senate loses and the American people lose. Why does the Senate lose? Because it is surrendering its constitutional prerogative to play a key role in vetting nominations by the president, conducting their own background checks, asking questions of the nominee to see if that nominee is fit for state or attorney general or whatever the department might be. And it, by sacrificing or surrendering its constitutional role, it tends to become less and less important in the constitutional scheme. And it's already become very, very diminished in foreign affairs and for other reasons that we've discussed When you add this to it, it makes the U.S. Senate appear to be more and more the role of a lapdog. I say the American people lose as well. Why do we lose when we don't follow the process of advice and consent? For the simple reason that we don't know if people assuming these positions, these very important principal offices, are in fact qualified to hold those positions. Our confidence that they are on occasion fit is derived from the fact that the Senate is playing its constitutional role to advise and consent. That's how we can assume these are fit men and women. That's how we can hold some confidence in their appointments. But if there's no vesting process, no vetting process, if there is no advice and consent role to place by the Senate, we have no idea about these nominees presented to us by the president. That also diminishes our accountability. And what's the other problem? And this is the problem that leads to corruption, which is in the headlines of American newspapers today. If the president can choose acting heads of departments and key offices, and those people don't have to go through the advice and consent process, to whom are they loyal? To whom do they owe their principal loyalty? Well, the answer clearly is to the man who put him in that position. This is the kind of corruption that is rife in the administration and is appearing in so many different areas now as we conduct these investigations, whether it's through the Oversight Committee, the Intelligence Committee, the House Judiciary Committee, and others. So what I'm presenting to you in just this quick snapshot, but which I could fill out if we had another 5 or 6 hours together, is the idea that this presidency is unaccountable and that it is imposing or inflicting excruciating pressure on our system of checks and balances to the point where I think we are at an inflection point. Let me say that again. I say that with all due immodesty in the confidence that I have in this statement. We are at an inflection point. Our system was created by James Madison and Alexander Hamilton and the boys to provide a system in which ambition is intended to counteract ambition. That was the famous line written by James Madison in Federalist 51, in which we maintain governmental accountability because different governmental departments will share powers with others, making it rare that any unilateral decisions can be made. And there will be ambition on the part of the person holding the office, a personal ambition, not to be run roughshod over, not to see his or her rights and powers and responsibilities torn asunder, and comparable interest in maintaining the strength of the institution that they serve so that that institution is not weakened to the point where it becomes irrelevant. That was the brilliance, that was the genius of the system created by our founding fathers. But today we witness the erosion of that institutional system. Checks and balances are not playing out, and in large measure they're not playing out because the president is beating the devil out of those institutions that would check the president almost on a daily basis. We could speak for several hours about his attacks on an independent press. So important, the framers of the Constitution believed, that we have an independent press, a free and independent press, that they enshrine protection for the press in the First Amendment. Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of the press. We don't have any other comparable protection. That's how much the framers prized a free press. Even though so many of the framers who later serving in Congress would have beef with the press from time to time and wonder what's wrong with you crazy people, and well, they would occasionally criticize, indeed rip, an article, they would never reach the point of saying that the press is, quote, the enemy of the people. When Donald Trump uses that phrase, and you all have heard him say it dozens of times if you've heard him say it once. He is drawing upon one of the darkest, ugliest phrases ever used in the course of human history, a phrase used by the revolutionaries in France in the 1790s, when France was going through the convulsions of revolution after revolution. The regime that finally emerged referred to all of its critics as, quote, the enemy of the people. What do you do with the enemy of the people? You put them to death. That phrase, the enemy of the people, was used then by Lenin and Stalin in Russia. When Donald Trump used that phrase to declare the press the enemies of the people, he had a particular agenda. And as you know, during the campaign trail, and to some extent still while he's been in office, he has encouraged people at his rallies to rough up reporters. He's called them out by name at the rallies. Look, back there, it's Katie Turr from NBC News. What scum she is. Using vitriol to describe people who are trying to provide us, we the people, with information that is necessary for us to make decisions about governmental policies and programs. And so much the vitriolic language reached the point that the publisher of the New York Times, Sulzberger, a year ago requested a meeting with the president in the White House to say, Mr. President, if ever you have a quarrel with our story, any story you think we're wrong, unfair, call me, let me know, but please stop referring to the press as the enemies of the people, because our reporters are under threat. Their security is imperiled. And even at the Times in New York, they now have to place extra security outside on the streets. So it's a very, very difficult time for reporters abroad and here at home. But President Trump has been beating the devil out of the free press, and we can all admit that the press on occasion makes mistakes. But what I always like to tell audiences is that every person in every industry on occasion would make a mistake. Lawyers do it. Doctors do it occasionally. Professors even. Well, maybe not. Not professors. But the key about journalists and their newspapers is when they recognize that they've made an error, they will print a retraction. That is an honest statement to the readers. Yesterday, you've all seen these. If you read the New York Times, you see them. Yesterday's paper got some facts wrong. Here's the correct version. I admire an industry that will own up to its errors, acknowledge its mistakes, because it can give us greater confidence in the press. Not only has President Trump then attacked the press and an independent press, as you all know, he's attacked the courts, declaring that judges of certain ethnic background cannot render objective opinions. Why couldn't that judge who grew up in Indiana rule that the president's policies on immigration were in fact unconstitutional, as President Trump explained it? Well, he's Mexican. He's a Mexican, meaning A, he can't render an opinion that is at all removed from his ethnic heritage, and that he must be deeply conflicted and biased in favor of immigration policies that would be helpful to immigrants coming to the United States. And of course, and I'll conclude here, you know that he beats up on the members of Congress who dare to disagree with him. He declares his opponents to be guilty of treason. Mitt Romney is guilty of treason. Anybody who dares to criticize him, meaning he's trying to diminish the independence of Congress. And I've heard from numerous members of Congress, Republicans and Democrats, but here more particularly Republicans, who disagree with President Trump, but they will not disagree publicly because they fear being attacked by the president of their party. Wow, talk about a successful intimidation tactic. Who thought that could happen in the United States of America? I'll stop here. Thank you. Thank you. And so, because we are a democracy, still a democracy, I invite your comments and questions and criticisms. And if we can, let's see, this is recorded. So let's see, do we need, will you run the mic around? Thanks, Jamin. If you can do that, thank you. So this will be rebroadcast. And this way, your voices and your question will be known to the deep state. The national security state needs to know your questions, please. Yep.
Two of our Idaho senators are in very powerful positions. Senator Crapo is head of the Judiciary Committee, and Senator Risch in charge of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Have you had a chance, or other constitutional scholars, to talk to these two Idaho leaders about some of these points that you've made this evening?
Good question. So I've tried. I've tried a little bit when I've seen them to ask about their exceeding deference to the presidency in all kinds of matters, particularly with respect to foreign affairs and the war power and a number of domestic issues. But as you might imagine, the position taken by those senators, and I should say members of the House as well, is that they are towing the party line. And so they're not likely, at least at this point yet, to criticize the president. So in a letter that I received from Senator Risch, who, as you point out, is the chair of the very powerful Senate Foreign Relations Committee, he agreed that, in fact, the Senate has a role to play in war making, forgetting to say it's Congress that has a role, that he would limit it to advice and consent. Wholly erroneous. It's Congress that makes the decision. The president does not have a decision to make in the decision to go to war. It's wholly a congressional power, as the framers of the Constitution intended, which would mean then he, as chair of that committee, has surrendered this most awesome of all governmental powers, delivered it up to a single person. Good question. Where are we?
Regarding executive immunity, if the judicial branch were to create a decision on some sort of lawsuit regarding the president, who would enforce that, being that the executive branch is supposed to enforce these laws that the judicial branch makes, or these decisions that the judicial branch?
That's a wonderful question. Yes, thank you. Got it. Thank you very much. So as you all know, when the federal courts issue a decision, they rely on executive or branch officials to enforce their decisions. It could be sheriffs, it could be the FBI, it could be a variety of law enforcement officials. In this particular case, as you would imagine, it would be very difficult if the United States Department of Justice is involved in trying to enforce a law against the president at present, because the Attorney General of the United States seems to be so much an ally of President Trump. Attorney General William Barr seems less interested in defending the integrity and the independence of the Department of Justice rather than pleasing the interest of the president. So that makes it very difficult. And as we mentioned last week, just to allude to an important point, when Congress subpoenas individual testimony or documents, the expectation is that people will comply with those subpoenas. We all have that responsibility as citizens. But as you know, President Trump, again here in a history-making mode, we might say, said to the congressional committees conducting investigations into his administration that we're not going to comply with any of the subpoenas. He was stonewalling. And that created a major problem for these congressional committees. How are they to acquire the information they need to conduct their inquiries? And just for your knowledge, the Supreme Court long ago in the 19th century held that the power of Congress to conduct investigations is sweeping, both to inform itself and to inform the United States, and also pursuant to its lawmaking and investigative functions. So against a sweeping power upheld by the Supreme Court for 200 years, the president would say, would defy this power. And so when the committees are stymied, because the members of the administration are unwilling to comply with the subpoenas, what is the recourse for the committees? Well, ordinarily they would go to the Attorney General and they would say, please enforce this subpoena for us. That's a non-starter with William Barr. That means Congress has to go to courts, which Congress has done. There are numerous lawsuits now at various stages asking the court to order certain Trump administration officials to appear, to testify, or to produce documents. But as you know, the Trump administration is fighting that path at every turn, and it's a long process. If you can appeal and appeal and appeal, you can delay it, perhaps after the 2020 election. And that's why I have said, written and said, that what the committees need to do is to draw upon the very old, tried and true method of tasking their sergeant of arms to go find that governmental official, whether it's Don McGahn, the former White House counsel, or Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, and arrest them, either sending them to the Washington, D.C. jail, or taking them to the old guardhouse in the Capitol. They have that authority. In 1821, in a case called Anderson versus Dunn, the great Chief Justice Marshall upheld the authority of Henry Clay, who was the Speaker of the House, to task the Sergeant of Arms to go make the arrest. When the person was arrested, he filed a suit, complained of unlawful imprisonment, and being treated unfairly and so forth. The court dismissed all those charges, upholding the sweeping power of Congress to make that arrest. My view is that is the best thing that Congress could do right now. Why? Because the TV cameras would be there as a new sergeant of arms, not a 95-year-old guy about this tall, 100 pounds, but Rambo or somebody like that who's been hired to go make the arrest. The cameras would be there. And then Nancy Pelosi and Adam Schiff and others could say, we wish we didn't have to resort to this old legal process, but in the Trump era, it's what we are left to do to protect the rule of law. And in the same way that you saw the TV cameras in the basement of the Capitol building yesterday, providing plenty of coverage of the 35 members of the Republican Party who stormed into the committee meeting, to great success from the conservative standpoint, or at least let me say this, not to the conservative standpoint, because I think Donald Trump's behavior has removed him far from the old standards and values of genuine conservatives in this country, but it certainly has served the interests of those who support Donald Trump. Likewise, the Democrats' interest in trying to acquire the testimony that they so desperately need to conduct these investigations to reach the truth would, I think, enjoy great appeal and admiration across the country. So far, they're not following my advice, but I wish that's what the House would do. So you ask a very good question, and we could, in fact, find ourselves in the position where the Supreme Court, ruling on any number of the cases that will be before it against Donald Trump, there we face the acid test of the effectiveness of the Republic. Would a president dare to ignore, to defy a Supreme Court ruling? And if the president did it, what then happens? More alarming, what if the president defies a Supreme Court ruling, nothing happens, and he prevails? That's why I say this is the acid test of the Republic. If the president could defy congressional subpoenas, for example, and defy a Supreme Court decision ordering the administration officials to go testify and prevails, what happens to the United States? At that point, ladies and gentlemen, our constitutional system has been dissolved. If a president can defy the other two institutions and defy a judicial subpoena, then game over. We no longer have an executive subordinate to the rule of law. At that point, we would all have to acknowledge the president is above the law. That's why I said earlier we are at an inflection point in our republic. And I would say that 1,000 times and not feel that I'm exaggerating at all. Thanks for asking the alarming question. Anybody have a friendly question that can produce some smiles and laughs, maybe? Please, yes, sir.
You mentioned before and then just now the congressional Republicans barging into the hearing room. And I think their point is that the President Trump is not getting a fair hearing. Mm-hmm. Maybe you can reflect on that. And also, where did the term Commander-in-Chief come from?
Oh, thank you. Two very, very good questions. I'm happy to address those. Thanks for asking. So on the first question, you're exactly right. Trump's defenders are asserting publicly that President Trump is not being treated fairly by the Democrats in this process being largely run by the chair of the House Intelligence Committee. Their primary complaint is that these inquiries are being conducted behind closed doors. And depending on which Trump supporter you listen to, it's a denial of a fair trial. It's a denial of due process. It's a denial of all rights. So let's focus on what is occurring at this stage. The first thing we want to say about the inquiry is that it's just that. It's a fact-gathering process, an information-gathering process, not unlike what a grand jury does. When you're there before the grand jury, we don't open it up to the public. Instead, you are there to tell the truth. You're asked questions. And let's remember something very important here, that you're not hearing from Trump supporters, that there are Republicans on these committees, the intelligence, foreign affairs, who are asking the questions. So to the extent that Republicans in Congress are saying, well, we're kept in the dark, we don't know what is being asked, that's wholly untrue. All they have to do is ask their colleagues on those committees. And those colleagues have equal opportunity to ask questions. So that's point number one. Point number two is that the testimonial period here, taking depositions, will see the light of day after this inquiry is concluded. It might be a couple weeks, might be a month. It will see the light of day because then all the business shifts to the House Judiciary Committee, where, in fact, there will be open testimony. Witnesses will be called on the various kinds of questions that we're hearing addressed now. Third, it's not as though Donald Trump is on trial. So the demagoguery on this issue is extreme. I guess that's a little bit repetitive. The demagoguery is extreme. I think that's what demagoguery is. That the president is not on trial, is he? At the only trial that he could face would be a Senate trial if the House of Representatives elects to find the president guilty of articles of impeachment. Then, as you know, the next stage in the impeachment process, if there is, in fact, an indictment of the president, is that the case moves to the Senate, and that's where the Senate sits as judge and jury. That is where he will have his defense counsel. So this is really being exaggerated here. This is taking depositions. And if you wonder, well, why do they do this behind closed doors? There are a couple of very good reasons. Number one, when you get witnesses who are willing to come in and testify, answer questions, particularly in these circumstances where the witnesses are people from the State Department who have been prohibited by the president from cooperating, but are doing so anyway because they believe it is their duty as a citizen to comply with a subpoena, which is surely correct, and their duty as a citizen to tell the truth, which is surely correct. And if we as a society, as a body politic, are not interested in the truth, well, there goes our constitutional democracy. That is the essence of a constitutional democracy. So if they were to go in that room surrounded by State Department lawyers, as Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, has demanded, how comfortable are they going to be in telling their truth surrounded by their supervisors? And secondly, to go back to the grand jury scenario for a second, we don't leak that word of a grand jury. We don't have outsiders asking questions. It's the House rules that the only people in that room are people on the committees asking questions. So really what Republican supporters of Donald Trump are doing now is seeking to distract from the substance of the testimony, attack the process, hoping to distract Americans so they get caught up in, this is an unfair trial. Donald Trump is not getting due process. He's not getting a fair trial. All erroneous descriptions, I think, and an exercise in obfuscation, deliberate confusion. And on the second question, the Commander-in-Chief Clause, thanks. So the first thing we would say is the framers of the Constitution did not invent that title, Commander-in-Chief. They borrowed that title from the English, who beginning in 1639, in one of their many wars with the Scots, decided to give that title, Commander-in-Chief, to the ranking military official in any theater of battle. Because you might be fighting a war on many different fronts, thus there would be numerous commanders-in-chief. And in England, the commander-in-chief never had the authority to initiate hostilities, to take the nation to war, and indeed was always inferior to a political superior, a cabinet member, the Lord Secretary of Defense, or the king himself. The founders embraced that long history when they decided to vest the president with the role of commander-in-chief. And because they had already decided in the convention that the president could not initiate military hostilities, that raises because that would be a congressional prerogative, solely and exclusively a congressional power, raises the question, well, what is the role for the commander-in-chief? As Alexander Hamilton explained in Federalist 69, essentially, the president as commander-in-chief has two hats to wear. In one, if the nation is attacked by a foreign country or foreign adversary, then we're in an emergency situation. We need not wait for Congress to assemble to drive out the invaders. Rather, as both Madison and Hamilton said in the convention, echoing the views of their colleagues, in that case, then the president has the duty to, quote, repel the invasion. That's what the president does, to repel the invasion. As soon as the invaders are driven out, then it becomes a matter for Congress to decide what our policy is going to be. We might wage war. We might declare war on the country that attacked us. Or we might sue for peace or different options. That's one role. The president would drive out the invaders. The second is, after Congress has either formally declared war, as we did 6 times in World War II, Italy, Bulgaria, Japan, Germany, etc., or Congress has authorized lesser military hostilities, whatever the decision of Congress is, then the president as commander-in-chief assumes responsibility for the conduct of that war or the hostilities. That's what the commander-in-chief does. And in reality, Congress will often defer to the president in deciding how to wage the war, which is simply another way of saying the president will defer to the generals and the admirals. But at any point, as I mentioned earlier, according to the Supreme Court, the Congress at any point can impose instructions and directions upon the president, even though he's commander-in-chief. And that was taken straight out of the appointment of George Washington in 1775 as general-in-chief and commander-in-chief. When Congress appointed him, it then provided, quote, you shall duly respond to instructions and directions imposed by Congress, end quote. So from the very beginning, we've always assumed that the commander-in-chief is subordinate to Congress, which holds, as James Madison said, the power to commence continue and conclude wars. Thanks for asking that question. Right over here, yes, sir, please.
As I wasn't impressed enough by the news of the day, thank you for a very engaging lecture.
Thank you.
You described the inflection point and gave a rather dire assessment of what could potentially happen.
Yeah.
Could you perhaps give us a rosier scenario?
Yes, a happy, optimistic version.
Please.
I can do that. Yes, sir. And I hope that this would become the version. So this is the way that the Republic, the great American Republic, redeems itself and lives on. In my view, the way this happens is that if President Trump is indeed impeached and by the House and then convicted by the Senate and removed from office, then in my view, we will have reached that point where a president with authoritarian pretensions is removed from power. And thus we would be left with a slightly different version in the form of Mike Pence, who is a deep conservative, but so far as we know, doesn't have the same personality and the same pretensions to authoritarianism. And then we simply return to a circumstance in which there is a profoundly conservative president in the White House dealing with a Congress that has a different viewpoint. We face that many times in our history. So when you raise a very nice question and you ask for an optimistic outcome, I do not find optimism in the following scenario: that Trump is impeached by the House and then goes on trial in the Senate but is acquitted. I find no optimism in that for the future of our constitutional democracy and the institutions, and here's why. Because he already seems to not recognize any limits on the presidency, as I've explained this evening. If he is acquitted, he will see no limitations, no inhibitions, and he will do what he wants to do in domestic and foreign affairs. So that would be my view on how we have an optimistic outcome. And yes, it does involve the removal of Donald Trump from office, because I don't see any other way to save our republic. Sorry to be so grim, but that's how I see it. Because institutionalism is the key to our constitutional system, and that is being assailed on a daily basis. And we could go on and on, but one of the deep disappointments, apart from President Trump's assertion of unlimited authority, and again, we've never heard that by any president in 250 years, beyond his assertion of unlimited authority, is, of course, the surrender, that is, the abdication by the Congress of its responsibilities and powers under the Constitution. Of course, I'm speaking of a single chamber here. I'm speaking about the Senate. I hope that, in fact, if and when President Trump is impeached and the case moves to the Senate, I'm not one of those commentators who says that the Republican Senate will automatically or certainly exonerate or acquit President Trump. I have hopes that there will be moderate Republicans who, upon viewing the evidence, and it's mounting in the form of a betrayal of the oath of his office, corruption, abuse of power, just focusing on Ukraine, that they will say to themselves, for different reasons, and their motives don't matter much to me, but for different reasons, for different motives, to say, we shouldn't have this person in the presidency. They might say it for their own political fortunes, which would be fine with me. They might say, he is an albatross, as public opinion polls now show that a majority, it's a thin majority, but a thin majority of the American people show in the polls now to be in favor of impeachment and removal. The NBC Wall Street Journal poll, the CNN poll, even a Fox poll shows that, in fact, Americans have become very alarmed. So a senator, Republican senator, might say, it's going to be difficult for me to defend President Trump. I would have an easier path to reelection if we don't have to deal with Donald Trump. That might be the motive of a number of Republican senators. And I'll tell you, the person to watch is the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, because McConnell has just started retreating from his indefatigable defense of Donald Trump. And you know, it exploded in a scene 2 days ago when Donald Trump was before reporters describing his call to the Ukrainian president. And he said to the reporters, you can see it on tape, I talked to Mitch McConnell, and Mitch told me this was a perfect call and an innocent call. Reporters then said, and you've seen this footage too, it's there. Then the reporters said to Mitch McConnell, President Trump has said you described his call to the Ukrainian president as perfect and innocent. And what did McConnell say? He said, I don't recall any conversations with the president about that phone call. The first time he has backed away from defending the president. So nothing is more important to Mitch McConnell than retaining Republican control of the Senate. If he decides that the best way to retain Republican control is to cut loose Donald Trump so there's not that albatross going into the November election, I have to believe he would do that. He would perform a calculus that suggests that's the way to save majority control. Because if he doesn't, then that's a nightmare for him, because the House would be controlled by the Dems, the Senate would be controlled by the Dems, and a very, very good chance that the presidency would be controlled by the Dems. Mitch McConnell doesn't want that landscape. So I think let's watch Mitch McConnell, see how he responds in the coming days. But there's tremendous pressure. Already you can see, I think, 5 or 6 or 7 Republicans in the Senate who are retreating, finding a bold note, if you will, willing to say this is of Trump. This is not a pretty picture. Senator Thune of South Dakota said that, right, just yesterday. This is not a pretty picture. This is not good for the president. He's the number two Republican in the Senate, right behind McConnell. If Thune feels confident to say that, that is giving cover or protection to other members of his caucus. I could go on about it, but that's about it. Where are we? Back there. Oh, yeah. My favorite teacher.
Well, my esteemed colleague, who also happens to be in the room, we were leaving the high school the other day, and we ended. And the reason I want to bring this up is because I don't know that I'm necessarily asking you to forecast. However, this gentleman here preceded my question with a rosier version as opposed to something more apocalyptic. But last Thursday, we also discussed about the nature of the sole power of impeachment and that it too changes with each impeachment that comes before us. So my esteemed colleague and I talked about the nature of institutions. And even though President Trump does, in fact, push the parameters of the Constitution, is it still strong enough to contain him and ultimately derail him, I guess? So, in regards to this gentleman's question about what is rosy and what is impending doom, is there a chance, Dr. Adler, that we are seeing the institutions working, although slowly? Yeah. As we see members of the administration or members of government agencies deeply rooted in history complying with the subpoenas and coming forward.
Yeah.
And should we see more and more of those, or should we see perhaps an approval rating drop as a result of something that happens on a Wednesday?
Mm-hmm.
Is there a possibility that even though our democracy is in a huge challenge, that it's actually working?
Mm-hmm. Excellent question and observation. Thank you. So I think that if in fact we find that the process goes forward and President Trump is impeached by the House, and we've seen one chamber acting to protect the Constitution because of the obvious corruption and abuse of power among other constitutional and thus impeachable offenses. The key, and this is why I like your question, the key question is what will the Senate do? If the Senate does indeed proceed to, after discussion and debate, to decide that President Trump has committed impeachable offenses and deserves to be removed, then I would say, yes, the institutions have fought back. The Constitution, as you suggest, has fought back, and it survived. Then we would know, and we could take a deep breath and say, okay, it looks like we're on the road back. That's what we could say. We might still face other great obstacles. Some Trump supporters have said President Trump might not leave the office. We face that question as shocking as it is, but we still would face a number of questions. But I think you're right. I think that's why the framers created the mechanism of impeachment. When they believe that a president has committed offenses so shocking to our constitutional system that you cannot wait until the next election to have a referendum on his behavior, that he represents a threat to the Constitution, either through usurpation of power, subversion of the Constitution, abuse of power, violation of his foreign affairs powers, and other offenses that they considered impeachable. That's when we face that acid test, I think. If in fact he is removed from office, then I'm more than willing to say that the system has worked. Why? Because it would require Republicans crossing over to join Democrats in the Senate to vote to convict and remove the president. I think that's right. Where are we? We're about out of time, so let's take a couple more questions. And are there any questions in Meridian? Anybody in Meridian have a question? We'd love to have. I see one there. Let's take that question. Please, go ahead.
So if we see, in fact, that President Donald Trump doesn't respect the people that he's working with, and that it is decided that he's impeached, but he doesn't respect that, what will happen?
So I didn't quite catch all that question. Did you, well, because we're how far away? 300 miles from Meridian, right? Thank you for asking. So were you asking whether or not the president respects those who work for him? Go ahead and ask that again, if you will, and I'll ask others in the room to help me hear it. Please.
What will happen if President Donald Trump doesn't respect, if he does receive an impeachment? What will happen to him? And what consequences can he expect?
Thank you. That's an excellent question. And a boost to the volume here did the trick. Or else you just raised your voice. Thank you very much. That's the right question to ask. The theory bears out that President Trump fails to respect the impeachment decision, then what happens? Well, that's when we face a real serious constitutional crisis, because who would order him to leave the White House? This almost moves us into material for a great movie, a high drama. Who orders him? Usually, you would see the Attorney General of the United States order the FBI to go remove the president. Would the Attorney General do that? Let's hope that after everything else that's occurred, that the Attorney General, who would want to uphold the Supreme Court's decision, would go to the president, order the president to leave, and to authorize his FBI agents to physically remove him if it comes to that point. But your question, what happens, is a very important question, because I think, along with a lot of people across the country, I fear violence. I fear violence among Trump supporters who would feel that the presidency was ripped away from them. Trump supporters who believe that the president was somehow treated unfairly, that the system was rigged, to employ his own language. So I fear violence. I have a deep concern about the potential for violence in this country. And I don't know how to, if we as a nation are on the brink, so to speak, I don't know how to withdraw from the brink is the problem. Because the Trump supporters are not about to cease tactics or strategies or aggressive actions that would in any way weaken their effort to keep President Trump in power and rolling along. And you can't just have a segment of the population, let's say Democrats or those people opposed to Trump, whom Trump, by the way, has called scum. That's his technical term, scum. You can't expect them to back away and preach the virtues and values of civility. Let's talk nicely. Let's use lawn tennis language. Let's have tea and crumpets. That's not happening. The natural reaction, of course, is there will be something of an equal reaction. Here we get Newton's physics. Any physics professors here? We're going to have an equal and opposite reaction. People won't back down. They will escalate. So I don't know how we pull back from the brink here. That alarms me. The only way I think that we could pull back from the brink is if there is very damaging testimony about Donald Trump, very damaging evidence about Donald Trump, whatever that involves, his personal or professional life, and it's exposed, and it so offends a significant number of his supporters that they say the heck with it. I think that's what is required for us to pull back from the brink. I do think, as Speaker Pelosi said the other day, that with him all roads lead to Putin. Or as others have said, with him all roads lead to Russia. I wish that Americans would be very, very concerned about what just happened in Syria, that American soldiers fought and died to protect that territory. 10,000 Kurds fought and died, and we worked hard to corral 10 to 15 to 20,000 members of ISIS, and now many of them have been released. They're on the run. They've escaped, and we've ceded that territory, and here come the Russians, as if we rolled out a red carpet. If you go back just 10 years ago, Republicans across the country, genuine conservatives, would have been up in arms if you had said, well, this territory we fought for, American blood was spilled, and we spent hundreds of billions of dollars. Let's just give it to the Russians now and let them occupy this strategic area in the Middle East. Who here believes 10 years ago Republicans would not have been outraged? Of course they would have been. Why not now? That's the strange question, makes me feel like I'm living in the Twilight Zone, except when I come here. So I think, oh, one more question, please. And thank you for that question in Meridian.
Okay, so far everything's kind of discouraging, but I want to ask you a possible...
That's what I do best, I discourage. Yeah, thank you.
I'm thinking of another scenario that Trump stalls for so long. He loves to do that. He loves to distract and stall. If he can stall this process of impeachment and we go through the elections, what do you think would be the outcome of the elections?
That's a very good question about the election. That's on everybody's mind, isn't it? So I think the key is, thank you very much, I think the key is to see what the voter approval levels look like for President Trump on into the next several months. He has consistently been in the low 40s. He's never gotten to 50, barely to 45 on occasion. It's now down to 41, 42%. If it falls below 40, it would be incredibly difficult for an incumbent president to win if, in fact, he only enjoys the support of 37 or 38% of the country. That is very difficult territory, which would make me believe that the Democrats would have a good chance of recapturing the White House. The problem, of course, is that it's not clear, A, who will be the nominee for the Democratic Party, and what policies will be the policies on which the Democrat runs. We don't know, for example, if a majority of the country is yet willing to embrace, let's say, Medicare for all as advocated by Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren, if one or the other should become the nominee. We don't know if that's the case. Would it be the case that the American people are more comfortable with somebody like Joe Biden, who's viewed as a centrist, and for all of his misstatements and speaking errors, some of which are pretty entertaining, despite his flaws, he is still Uncle Joe. And this is the time in America where people want to be comfortable with somebody in the White House that they like and they feel that they can trust. My view on Biden is those are some of the qualities that he brings that are probably going to be unique in the next race. And so it may be that the Democrats' best ticket includes Biden at the top. But it's by no means a sure thing. It's not even clear that he's the best candidate. But he may be acceptable to those key vote, to those voters in the key Midwestern states that were lost last time. You know them, the industrial states, Michigan, Ohio, Wisconsin, and so forth. Those have to, and Pennsylvania have to be recaptured. I think Biden, among all candidates, appeals very much to the middle class, and those are the workers that were lost last time around. It's hard to project. You ask a very fine question. It's hard to project at this point because there can be so many ups and downs. If Joe Biden were to continue to make misstatements, errors of fact, and he's overtaken, as he has been in Iowa by Elizabeth Warren, he may not be the candidate. And so it's still too early to see how this shakes out. I think a lot depends on whether Bernie Sanders stays in the race, because I think a lot of his supporters are also supporters of Elizabeth Warren, and she is a great fighter. She's very smart. She is dogged. I don't think she would be intimidated by Donald Trump. But who knows if Donald Trump will be the standard bearer for the Republican Party. And that's how, because if he's impeached and removed, because Republicans think they'll lose the White House and potentially the Senate with him, they might turn to somebody else. So there's still a lot that could happen. So strap yourselves in. This impeachment inquiry is pretty exciting, pretty dramatic stuff. And we all know that curse, right? We want to live in interesting times. Well, we're living in interesting times. So I really appreciate you all coming out tonight. If you're interested, we'll continue to do some of these constitutional conversations on timely and important issues and topics. And let me ask you, is 6 o'clock the best hour or 7 a better hour? Do you have preference? Does it make any difference? 6, okay. And Meridian, thanks for tuning in. And I hope you come back next time. And thanks for that great question. And more good questions to come from all of you. So thank you, and thanks to KISU. Good night.